homework was assignment was nothing you should turn in, but I'm going to warn you in advance that three classes from now I'm going to talk in detail about DES, linear and differential cryptanalysis. You should understand the guts of it pretty well. One of the homework problems taught you that in some gruesome detail. These two sites will give you even more gruesome detail. So. Okay, so the first homework problem was to encrypt something using a Biguenier cipher with a direct standard alphabet with the keyword Josh. And don't forget, a direct standard alphabet just means the alphabet is in order. So the Biguenier table that you use to encrypt this, nobody had problems with it, so I won't explain it in tremendous depth. Under A should have J-O-S-H, and then the letter should follow. And if you do that, whoops, gosh, I'll learn how to do this someday. You get something like this. I'm sorry, this is the unencrypted version. I just broke it into five texts. This is the encrypted version. Actually, I think there's a slight mistake here. I think and I will correct the slides, I think the index of coincidence is 0.45. There are actually two ways to calculate the index of coincidence, and books are sloppy on this. One is to just sum up the square of the frequencies, and the other slightly more accurate way to do it is the sum of the frequency number of characters over n times the number of characters minus 1, and you get slightly different answers, but you get about between 4.5 and 4.8. And so what this should, yes? So this, what this should indicate to you, that number, having never seen the unencrypted text, you should look at it and say, this can't possibly be a mono alphabet, because if we're a mono alphabet, the index of coincidence would be much higher. So that was what this was supposed to teach you.
I thought you wanted us to break into four columns and then show
the index. That's next. That's the ciphertext I want you to break into four columns. And it turns out I have copied this wrong on the slides. I'll correct this before I post it. Let me just put my...
Well,
I came from a totally different thing. Anyway, so I asked you to break the text into four columns, and I picked the number four because the key was four letters long. And what this should tell you, looking at these index of coincidences again, is the columns, at least a couple of them, should have been enciphered in a mono alphabet because the index of coincidence is high. And that's a clue for the second problem. So in the second problem, one of the techniques you could have, and maybe should have used, was to break the text into some number of columns, do the index of coincidence of each of the columns, and when it seemed big, you should have smelled a rat and said that was, it was, you know, that number of alphabet. Yeah.
Judge, is it four of them? Because, I mean, you know, some of those big ones are...
No, there's no real scientific... Again, there's variation. I could go through a very long explanation of statistics and tell you the probability of the variance of all these. In the end, for these kinds of ciphers, it's a little bit seat of the pants. If you see four bad index of coincidences, there's no chance, right, essentially. But no, I've seen pretty crappy index of coincidences for one out of three or four alphabets, and it was, you know, basically was that. So there's
pretty much, if you get one good one.
Yeah, if you get, you should, again, you should look carefully if you get one good one. Okay, so question two was the one, I think there was great variation. It seemed like most people got question two, but some people spent an enormous amount of time on it, I think. So, break the Biguenier cipher below, and I give you the plaintext. Again, you know that it was a direct standard alphabet. So one of the things that these problems should have taught you is if I don't tell you it's a direct standard alphabet, if the alphabet is mixed, the problem's much harder. If you have a mixed alphabet component, it's much harder. There's still ways to do it. In fact, there's a fairly tricky thing using group theory that makes it not as easy as a direct standard, but close. Anyway... So I'll tell you a couple of clues about how I did it. Your mileage may vary. And in fact, I noticed today while I was doing, while I was coming in for the class, there's actually a little bit more you could have learned. And I found another one just a minute ago. Hang on. Another repetition.
Nine of them all together.
Yeah, see, this is the kind of thing I'm bad at. The first step in solving any polyalphabetic substitution is find out how many alphabets are used. And there are basically two ways to do this. So I'm going to show you both ways. Either way is okay. So the first thing you do is the thing we call the Kasaki, or which I'm mispronouncing, method, and that's to look for repeats. The hypertext that's duplicated. And what I said last time is if you have a run of duplicated text that's any more than two characters long, like three or four, it's very likely that that repeated text happens because the difference in the first letter of the first repeat and the second letter of the first repeat is a multiple of the number of alphabets used. So in this case, and there were two that I picked out, and one is this I right off the bat, IGDL and IGDL, and they're separated by a distance of 20. Yes?
Never mind. I guess you were saying RRIP UERX.
Yes, that continues. I should have colored in that.
Oh, okay.
I just, you know.
Okay.
I'll fix these little things before I post it. So that second one is an enormous repeat. There is no chance on God's earth that that could be by accident. So that one, guaranteed. So the distance in that one is 25. And the distance in the last one, which is 5 long, which again is so long it could not have happened by accident, is 35. And if you look at the least common denominator of, greatest common denominator, which the British call highest common factor, I've learned, of these three, it's our favorite number, 5. And again, I wanted to make it a little bit easy. It also happens to be the way you broke the text up in standard stuff. So there's either one alphabet or 5 alphabets. Yeah?
What happens is more than 2 characters.
Yeah, 2 characters could happen by accident. There's a 1 out of 26 chance that you'll get a repeat in 2 characters. I mean, if you're desperate, you can try anything you want, and in the end, but I don't recommend looking for a duplicate of 2 characters. I'd say 3 and 4 is really what you're kind of looking for.
If you do it systematically across the whole message, actually you get a really strong signal.
So at this point, you could have looked at it and said 5 alphabets, to tell you the truth. But again, just to go over this thing in a little more detail, so you do the index of coincidence of the full cipher. The index of coincidence is low, so it's not one alphabet. And what I did next was to break it into the 5 alphabets, and this is how I actually did it. I'm not good at looking for runs. If you look at the index of coincidence of the 5 columns, they're all high. That should be how you did it. That's one of the classic ways to do it. Yes?
So one of the things that threw me off was at this point I decided to, after I break it into 5 columns, to take the frequency of the letters in each column and see how English frequencies. But I found that in some cases the frequencies were quite a bit off.
It's crummy in some ways. And in fact, the next technique, which I didn't show you, so you might have proceeded at this point with a sort of trial by error thing. So one thing you could have done just now is look for the highest 3 or 4 frequency letters in each of those 5 alphabets and try to make one of them be E or T, or I forget what the fourth one is, and the next most frequent, something over that. That's kind of painful, to tell you the truth. And I always guess wrong. So here's a technique I used, which I imagined you could have thought up, but there are other techniques in the references I gave you. But it was interesting because it produced, again, such a strong signal. What I did was I took the normal alphabet, A, B, C, D, E, F, G, and the frequencies of the letters in the normal alphabet, and I took the frequencies in this alphabet, A, B, C, D, E, F, G. And what I did was I looked at the distance between the frequencies for each column. This is when you look Euclidean space. In other words, I took the frequency of A in the first distribution, frequency of A in the second distribution, subtract them and square them. And I took the frequency of B, subtracted those two and squared them. Okay, so I get a Euclidean distance. And I just slid the normal alphabet across all 26 columns. And the correct alphabet should have the minimum distance from the slid alphabet. In other words, when I get the A lined up against the first correct letter, I should have comparatively small distance. And it's a nice sensitive test because it doesn't depend frequently on one little letter like E. So that's what I did, and that's what this text indicates, yes.
Is that also known as the chi-squared? Or is that different?
There is a chi-squared statistics, and I forget if this... No, I don't think chi-squared is a statistic, and it's not a simple distance. It may be related to this, but... Another reference, incidentally, now that you mention it, is a book called Statistical Methods of Cryptanalysis by Kolbach, where the chi tested. But I didn't do that. Yes?
I found something on the web. It's actually called calculates the dot product between each column and the frequency of the network.
Oh, that's another way.
The maximum number is actually what you want.
Yep, that's another projection. That's another good way. Again, you'd slide them across and see where you got the best one. But this was the simplest dumb-minded thing I could think of. And I did the calculation, and it just fell out. If you look at the lowest distance, you get M for the first alphabet, Y for the second alphabet, and now you already should smell success. MY sounds like a starting out a word. And then KEY. Interestingly, K had the worst one. So that's how you do it. And if you wrote out the Vigenère square based on that, you'd get this. Right, and then you apply the decryption, and you get a very famous text. I think this is from Lincoln's second inaugural. And it's actually a fairly, this is a medium difficult cipher, because E, in a lot of ciphers you really do see lots of E's. This one you don't. So, you know, if you just did the totally simple-minded thing of looking for E, lots of times you'd be okay, this time you wouldn't have been okay. Okay, so the other thing I asked, and again, I know the TA who's grading this is not in the room, but I'll give a little bit of guidance on the grading, is, so the first question is, how much corresponding plain and cipher text, if you have K alphabets, do you need to break the cipher? And the answer is K. That one actually is K, period. If you have K consecutive corresponding plain and cipher text letters, you can break it. That's it. Okay, in this case, K is 5. Five alphabets. Now, the second answer, I'm willing to take much more latitude in the answer. It's how many ciphertext-only letters do you need? And now that you've determined there are K alphabets, what this means is how many letters do I need to know to actually peg at least one letter exactly right? And I'll take any small multiple, anything from about 8 up to about 50.
Are we still assuming the direct standard alphabet?
Direct standard alphabet. Now, it's true what you're about to say. If I have as many as 50 letters in each of the... If I have 50K letters, I can solve it even if it's not a direct standard alphabet. But, again, I'll be fairly liberal. I didn't tell you how to do this. What I'm looking for is it's linear in K, and it's not too big a multiple. It's the multiple you're going to explain how you picked to say how you pick the letter out of that new alphabet.
Yes.
I saw two hands. Yes. Sorry.
Yeah. One of the slides in the last lecture, it said the unicity for a standard cipher was about 4K.
Yeah, and I think that's too small. So if you said 4, that's fine. If you said 4K, you're perfectly okay. But in looking at this particular example, if you looked at only this thing and said 4, what are you crazy? I wouldn't, you know, I'm not sure I'd... I could say too much about that, yes.
I had a question about saying we have plain and cipher and we only need K. That's assuming that we know it's K long.
Yes. So
my
this
argument is you
yes.
kind of 2K to see a repetition.
Well, you may need a lot more than 2K to see a repetition, but it says, I hope the question said, I'll go back, but it should say, if you have a K letter...
Well, you just need to know that it's K length.
Yeah, you just have to know that it's K length, yeah. So anyway, it's not linear in K if you don't know what K is.
So this was kind of a hypothetical objection, but, you know, depending on what our plain text is, we might not even be able to know when we got the right answer, right? I mean,
yeah, but it's extremely unlikely. This statistics is your friend. It's really rare when you do a correct...
totally random. How would you ever know that you got...
No, it was English text. I told you it was English text. Okay. That's right. If it were totally random, then you'd be in a little bit of trouble here. But no, English text. Here we go. Okay.
John?
Yes?
I was going to ask, if you have less than 2K letters, at least for part of the cipher, it's equivalent to a one-time pad for that part of the cipher that only has one...
If you have less than or equal to K letters, it's equivalent to a one-time pad.
Right, but for the part of the message where you only have one ciphertext letter corresponding to the alphabet, that part is equivalent to a one-time
head. Is a one-time head, that's right. And in fact, that would be a perfect cipher, as we're going to see in a problem from now, except for this little ugly problem of having lots and lots of key. Okay.
A question.
Yes.
I have a program to do that, encryption and decryption.
Yeah.
And I found some case like it's way more than 25K. You still cannot.
Well, multiples of 25 will also give good answers for the number of alphabets.
But that's certainly, to me, is not the upper limit. You know? It could be higher than that.
Oh, it could be higher than 25K?
Yeah.
Yeah, as I said, it's a little bit of an art. In fact, the number given, if you took a standard cryptanalysis course in the 50s during the, just after the war, the actual number of letters they say you typically need for a non-direct standard alphabet, for a mixed alphabet, is about 22 to 23. But there are cases that are more than that, even for a not,
this particular question is asking, do we have an upper limit? That means upper
limit. No, I didn't say upper limit. How many letters I said about?
So if I can have a case more than 25K, it will beat your answer, right?
So if you picked something like 50K, that would have been fine. That's my instructions to the person grading it, is the answer is linear in K, and I'm looking for a number between about 4 and 50, something like that is the coefficient. And you should explain why you picked that coefficient.
But that's not enough for the answer, right?
Because it isn't. Certainly was enough for this answer.
I know. You could be, any time you pick like 50.
That's right. That's the whole thing about statistics, right? In fact, is that there may be an edge case where it's just no truth.
But my understanding is there's no limit here. Because you cannot.
If you have completely random text, that's true. But again, no English text isn't random. The question is a statistical one. Not
you could certainly craft a
you could certainly
pathological
craft, you bet I could do that no sweat.
Yeah.
Yeah, and in fact here it is AAA BBB CCC BBB.
Well, that's not English.
You know, I'm right. So, yeah. And in fact, there was this book written with no the letter E not appearing at all in the book. I've forgotten the name of it. But
Paris.
Okay. Anyway, it was a statistical question, so the answer should have been something linear in K. And what I'm saying is, you have the latitude in this thing, as long as you picked an explanation why you picked the coefficient of K for that to be okay. And that's why, it does vary. Okay, the next question was to, and in fact, I'm going to stop by, I promised Josh I'd stop at 7. I'll post these slides with the corrections I made in it. The next question is, suppose you have a message source, M, with the following distribution. The chance you get a character, the bit 0, is P, and the probability that you get the bit 1 is Q. And of course, P plus Q equals 1, since there's nothing else in this nice binary alphabet. And consider, I said, and then you have a pad. These are an unfortunate set of letters. Suppose you have a pad, and the probability of having 0 in the pad is 1, one half in any position, and the probability of having a 1 at any position is 1 half. I ask you to calculate four things. The first thing I ask you to calculate is the entropy, or I guess we'll just call it entropy, of the message source, the entropy of the pad, and the entropy of the ciphertext. And then I ask you to calculate the information you learn from the message given the ciphertext. So that was the first question. The second question is that same thing all over again, but I changed the distribution of the pad. Instead of being 1/2, 1/2, I use 3/4, 1/4. Okay? And so it's comparatively straightforward. I know some people had a problem with the joint distribution, but for some reason I answered this out of order. But here it is. So the entropy of the text, remember, it's the sum of P sub I minus the sum of P sub I log base 2 of P sub I. And so that's that for the text input. I calculated, for the pad, the probability of 0 is 1/2, and the probability for 1 is 1/2. So that's easy. It's 1/2 log 1/2 minus 1/2 log 1/2, which is 1 bit, which is what you'd expect. There's 1 bit of information in a random bit. So that works out peachy. If you had any trouble with this part at all, it might have been calculating this, the entropy of the ciphertext, but it's fairly easy. The ciphertext can either be a 0 and a one, or 1. A 0 can occur because the message is 0 and the pad is 0, or it can happen because the message is 1 and the pad is 1. So you multiply these two probabilities and add them, and what did I just do there? Yeah, so you add them, P plus Q is 1, and so it's 1/2. Okay? And then I ask you to calculate the information that you got about M from C, and the thing we had in the notes was it's the entropy in M before you know anything about C, and then it's the entropy in M given C, and that's equivalent to this thing. Okay, and I just did a direct calculation. I keep on thinking you can see me when I'm pointing, but it doesn't really work. I substitute this down here. I have the distribution for the C there, 1/2 P. I substitute all that in, and where'd it go? So this is H of M. This is H of the pad, 1 bit. And this is H of the cipher, C. And the way you calculate H of the cipher is I'm looking for 4 values. I'm looking for the probability that M is 0 and C is 0. And that happens when the K is 0, which has, right? So I add up all these numbers and I calculate it. The probability that M is 0 is, I hope they wrote that somewhere. All right, so I'll just do it. The probability that M is 0 is P. The probability that C is 0 when M is 0, right, because it's and, joint distribution is and. The only way that C can be 0 and M is 0 is when the XOR bit is 0, which happens with probability 1/2. So this probability is P times 1/2. This probability is P times 1/2. This probability is Q times 1/2, and this probability is Q times 1/2. And so if you add all that up and subtract them, a magical thing happens, and that you get 0. So what this teaches you, what you prove here is an important theorem, a one-time pad is perfect. You learn no information. If it really has probability distribution 1/2 for the bits, there's no information you can learn from the message given the ciphertext about a cipher. And so, actually, this is the one and only real theorem in whether things are breakable or not. So enjoy it while you have it, because everything else is sort of a guess. Okay, the second problem, and again, I'll give a little bit of instruction. I'm not going to go through this, because we only have 5 minutes. So I'll jump to the point. You do the calculations precisely the same way. There are 3 things you should learn from this example. First of all, when the distribution of the pad is 3/4, 1/4, it's not 1 bit. It's less than 1 bit of information in the pad. About 0.81. The second thing you should learn, and I don't care if you simplified the expression, but if you calculate the information on the message given the ciphertext, you will get a non-zero number, and which will depend on P and Q. So what you learn from this is if you have a pad where you don't have the probability that each bit doesn't occur with equal probability, you do learn information from the cipher given the message. Yes?
The other thing I learned is that the result equals the entropy of C minus the entropy of the pad.
I don't know if that's generally true.
I don't know if it's generally true or not.
I don't know. I'll get back to you on that one. But in any case, it's non-zero. You've learned something. Okay, so one bright person in the class embarrassed me. Actually, the first time I wrote my DES program, I wrote it on a Sun machine, which was a big Endian machine. And I converted everything in from big Endian. So the question actually as stated was wrong. It didn't matter to your answer, incidentally, but it was actually wrong. The input turns out not to be 31, 32, 33, 34 hex. But 3-4-3-3-3-2-3-1 hex. It doesn't actually affect the answer for the reason you'll see, but I did a bad thing, so I'm sorry. Okay, so how do I want to explain this? This is actually a fairly important question. I did it two ways. The first thing I did was I wrote a program. So first thing, actually, let's go over the question. I gave you the input to round one, which was correct given the endianness. I should have never told you this because this could have thrown you off. And I told you the round keys for the first two rounds. Okay, that's what I told you.
Was there an email on the list about this correction?
No, one person sent me a personal mail, and I figured if I tried to explain this to people in mail, it would even get them worse. So if you ignored the non-useful piece of information, you would be better off yet.
Well, I am glad that I actually did so much work on the homework that I didn't get to this problem, because just from my perspective, I would have hated to spend 4 hours doing this.
Well, you should, again, if you do it directly...
In fact, confused by the numbers that you gave us. You know?
Yeah, so maybe the lesson is don't put any more information in the question than people absolutely need to solve the problem. But anyway, I'm going to... So first of all, I wrote a program. And so this slide has the answers. And I noticed many people got the answers. I'll post this on the site. They're just binary digits. I'm going to actually go over how you do the first round so you see it, because I did that by hand. Let me do the... Where did the hand go? Yeah. So let me do one round by hand. So you have 32 bits, which is the left-hand part of the message, and 32 bits, which is the right-hand part of the message. The first thing I did was write down the 48 round key bits for the round. The next thing I did was write down the right hand, this 32-bit block, expanded using that expansion matrix in DES. And I wrote that underneath. I get this 48-bit quantity. Okay? Remember what happens is what I do now is XOR these two quantities together, which means if I see two zeros, I put a zero. If I see two ones, I put a zero. If I see a zero and a one, I put down a one underneath. And I get this 48-bit quantity. Then I take I apply the SBOX. And again, the warning I gave you last time is when you apply the SBOX list in the publications list the S boxes in the following order. There are four 16-bit columns. The first bit and the last bit pick the row. So, for example, in this first example, 0, 1, and the row start at 0. You count like computer scientists. Row 0, row 0, 1, row 1, 0, row 1, 1. Okay? So, what I do to calculate the S box 1 output was I look in row 01, the second row in the S-box. I look for the number that's 89. I go over 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. And I look at the thing supposed to be substituted for that, and that's a 6. These are all hex numbers. Okay? And I do that for each of the 8 S-boxes. Okay? Then I took that answer, I wrote it down in binary again, and I applied the permutation which diffuses these bits. Okay? And that gives me the function, that's the definition of the function, FK1R. Okay? Then I XOR that nice thing with the left-hand round. And I get that with that. You can't see when I point with my hand, my finger. Okay? And then remember there are two involutions in a round of DES. The first is this XOR operation, and the second is switching the left and right hand side. So I did this one by hand. Okay, I'm actually going to, the rotor one is only going to, I'm going to talk about that only for a minute. It was extra credit anyway. Somebody noticed the problem here. The problem is basically I miscopied it. That should have been a plus I, and that should have been a minus I. The I corresponds to the rotor turning. And if you follow the group theory through, the thing comes in at this side. Each I turns at one. That's what corresponds to the C. And then it turns the other way. You get credit whether you did the correct equation or not. But you just follow the substitution. So first you pick I equals 0. Some people started at 1. That's okay too. That's instructions for the TA. Because I didn't actually say start at I equals 0. And then you apply the permutations in order. And that's what you get if the question is asked, and that's what you get with the correct here. Yes.
For question number four. Doing it by hand just seemed awfully tedious. I mean, I kind of understood from the slides before that it was difficult to do it. Were we supposed to gain someone else from doing that by hand? I mean, what was the purpose?
By doing it by hand?
Aside from realizing that.
Well, so again, you could have done it by hand or computer, but if you do it by hand, when I do linear cryptanalysis, you'll have a much better intuition about why things work the way they work. And in general, it's kind of like in any math thing, you should do one example by hand and then say, thank God I don't have to do it again. I don't have to do the calculation again. Because you often learn something by that. So the reason, there is a reason, and that is the more you, if you do it once by hand, you'll, you know, you feel like DES is your best buddy and you'll understand the whole thing. Okay, again, the index coincidence, well, so here, the fifth problem, here's what I want to teach you. Again, it's extra credit. You can't lose credit for this. You can only get credit. For 50 letters, because the rotor is changing and uses 26 alphabets, you'd expect the distribution to be very nearly random in a one-rotor machine. On the other hand, if you have corresponding plain and ciphertext, you only need one or two letters to break the cipher. I'll tell you why one or two. It's actually complicated. If you had only ciphertext, you need about 50. And again, to use the 50, you'd have to use a trick. You'd have to translate all the letters back. You know, you'd have to try them all and then do the frequency count. The reason you might have one or two is you could try each of the 26 possible positions for the rotor, for I, and figure out whether you have the corresponding plain and ciphertext. However, and usually that will work. The same thing happens in DES when you guess a key. If you have a plain text input and a ciphertext output, and you find a key that does that operation, you're probably golden. You probably have found the correct key. But it's not guaranteed. So, in fact, typically, well, not typically, sometimes you need a second letter to disambiguate. And that's because the equation you're trying to solve, there's an I and a J which are different, which may produce the same answer for a single P. But it's extremely unlikely for two letters they would. Okay? So that's it. The purpose of the homework is to actually teach you several things. That particular problem is you could have great statistics on a cipher and it still be a lousy cipher with just a little bit of information, namely one or two plain ciphertext. You should have learned a one-time pad is perfect, and you can actually prove that yourself. You should have learned how DES works, and you should have been welcomed to the fraternity of cryptographers by breaking that one cipher. So that one cipher should have, you know, when you saw the plain text, that should have been a happy day or happy hour or something. Thanks.
You're going to post all the skits.
But I'm afraid.